Chapter 13, The Three Worlds. After three stormy days in the Bay of Bengal, where the small craft bobbed up and down on the waves like a cork, we sailed through the smoother waters of the Malacca Straits and down to Singapore. We were still a mile from the harbour when we saw the quayside aswarm with thousands of ant-like figures. These were Japanese prisoners of war. Some, stripped to the waist, were unloading cargo. But most, lined up as though on parade, were apparently waiting to go aboard the steamers that had been sent to repatriate the defeated army. Driving through the streets of Singapore, we saw more prisoners, this time in squads of 100, marching down to the docks. At a command from their NCOs, they saluted smartly as our lorry passed. The five or six suburban villas allocated to the unit had been occupied by Japanese officers, from whom we inherited not only household effects, but servants. The latter were short, slender-bodied Malays, with light coffee complexions, who always wore singlets and colourfully striped sarongs. Perhaps they had stayed on, serving with the same smile, now one and now another set of victors, ever since the original dispossession of their wealthy Chinese masters. An advance guard of wireless mechanics, having already rigged up a set room in one of the villas, we were soon back on duty. But the war had ended, and there was no longer any more unidentifiable transmissions for us to intercept. This the CO evidently knew, for we worked only 4 hours a day. There were no night duties. We had not thumbed our way into Singapore more than once or twice before we realised that it was a city of Chinese. All the European-style shops and restaurants in the centre of the town were owned and managed by these cheerfully industrious people. The slender, handsome boys with their pale gold complexions and black slant eyes, who, in white singlets and shirts, pedalled the tricycle rickshaws with a loud ringing of bells, were Chinese. Their friendly but independent bearing was in marked contrast to the behaviour, alternately obsequious and blustering, of the Indian rickshaw pullers. Chinese, too, were the tiny, silken-trousered prostitutes, who, scenting business, walked stiff-legged along the pavement with little jerky steps. The few Malays one encountered were either doorkeepers, domestic servants, or bearers in restaurants. The Chinese quarter of the city, with its perpendicular shop signs, restaurants with wooden stools out on the pavement, sleek-haired women in black silk trousers and wooden clogs, grey-bearded old philosophers in long black gowns, and swarms of fat yellow children, was, like the Chinese quarters of cities all over the world, simply a slice of China. It even smelt Chinese. Despite their commercialism, or perhaps even because of it, most Chinese of all, in a sense, were the three worlds, the New World, the Great World, and the Happy World. In one of these amusement parks, a few days after our arrival, I sat with Ernie, who had joined us from Delhi. All the food and drink available was a bottle of orangeade and a few peanuts. The bill came to $3. But before a month had passed, the ever-resourceful Chinese businessman had pulled all the necessary strings, and the shops in each of the three worlds were crammed with luxury goods, and the restaurants redolent of every kind of food. Nightclubs and cabarets flourished. I contented myself by buying writing brushes and incense. The latter, rather to the disgust of my roommates, I burned every night before going to sleep. By the time life at the Worlds reached its pre-war gaiety, provision had been made for all possible tastes, from the grossest to the most refined. Once or twice I visited the traditional Chinese theatre. buskined actors in costumes of gorgeous brocade declaimed and sang in unnaturally falsetto voices. Whenever there was any movement on the stage, a furious clashing of cymbals would break forth, accompanied by the thudding and shrilling of less familiar instruments. Performances were interminable, seeming to last the whole afternoon and evening. As in Elizabethan and Jacobean England, the female roles were played by boy actors. Though the music was to me simply a noise, my experience of Indian classical music convinced me that with proper study I would eventually be able to enjoy it no less than its Western counterpart. If I could appreciate Chinese poetry and painting, why not Chinese music too? At the same time, perhaps owing to my lack of technical knowledge on the subject, I could not help feeling that a people's music was closer to its soul, hence more recondite, more difficult of access, than were its sister fine arts. At the other end of the scale was the all-in wrestling. Gigantic Sikhs, long hair tied up in topknots and lithe bodies glistening with oil, struggled and strained beneath the arc lamps with heavy muscle-bound Chinese. Negroes, Malays and Europeans all competed. Alf, the ex-minor roommate who had persuaded me to accompany him, leaned forward in his seat, following every hold and throw with intense excitement. Unable to appreciate the finer points of the art, I felt bored. The reactions of the audience were to me of greater interest than the tricks of the wrestlers. Whenever a joint cracked, a hiss of satisfaction would go up from the crowd. At the sight of blood, it howled with delight. In the ringside seats, wives of high-ranking army officers applauded vigorously. The Indian Quarter, a small island in the sea of Chinese humanity, was the dirtiest and most unsavoury section of the entire city. Shop signs were mostly in Tamil, for although no part of India was without its representatives, most Singapore Indians were of Dravidian stock. As I was about to turn into a side street in which I hoped to find the Singapore centre of the Ramakrishna Mission, I noticed a red "out of bounds" sign. After a wary glance up and down the main street for military policemen, I slipped into the turning and was soon vigorously rattling the collapsible gates of the mission building. The monk in charge must have been astonished to see a young British soldier. After a few minutes, however, we were chatting easily. He was a stout, elderly man of medium height. Kantaraj had told me that by reason of his absolute imperturbability, he was known to the mission as Buddha Maharaj. Certainly there was something Buddha-like, not only in his unruffled demeanour, but in the expression of cheerful benignity which irradiated his face. Even his eyes smiled. He listened to the story of my association with the mission centres in Colombo and Calcutta with great interest, occasionally interposing a question about this or that Swami he had known, for since the Japanese occupation he had heard no news of them. Neither had the mission received any news of him. Only from the letter I wrote to Belair Math shortly afterwards did they learn that he was still alive. At one time, Buddha Maharaj told me with a smile, the building had been requisitioned by the Japanese army. Soldiers had bivouacked even in the shrine. On the return of the British, he had been called for interrogation, for unlike the Chinese, who remained basically loyal, the Indian community had actively collaborated with the Japanese. Through the intervention of an army officer, who was acquainted with the mission's work in India, he was released after a few hours. Thereafter, I was a regular visitor to the ashram. Buddha Maharaj told me much about the grim days of Japanese occupation. He also spoke of Subhas Chandra Bose, the commander-in-chief of the so-called Indian National Army, to whose bloodthirsty tirades I had sometimes listened in from Delhi. Though he did not explicitly admit the fact, he had evidently served under him as a sort of chaplain to the forces. Apart from a servant, the only other inmate of the ashram was a young Tamil novice. Visitors were rare. Among them, however, was a prominent Chinese Buddhist with whom, despite our great difference in years, I was speedily on terms of friendship. Tan Keng Lok was a Chinese businessman who for many years had played a leading part in Singapore Buddhist activities. Before the war, he had founded the International Buddhist Union, an organization which aimed not only at bringing together Buddhists of all nationalities, but also at a wider dissemination of the Buddha's teaching and a purification of certain aspects of popular Chinese Buddhist practice. During the Japanese occupation, he had suffered terribly. His eldest son had been arrested by the secret police and was never heard of again. There was not a Chinese family, he told me, of which at least one member had not been tortured to death. Other Chinese friends not only confirmed this report, but described in harrowing detail the different methods of torture. One of the milder ones was to pump several gallons of water into the victim and then jump on his stomach. The superstitious believed that the YMCA building, which had housed the secret police headquarters, was haunted by the ghosts of the thousands done to death within its walls. Under such a regime, Buddhist activities were out of the question. Two English books on Buddhism had, however, been published by a Japanese scholar attached to the cultural branch of the administration. Whether he considered that the behaviour of his fellow countrymen accorded with Buddhist principles was not made clear. Besides inviting me to his own home, where we discussed Buddhism over glasses of orangeade, Tan Keng Lok showed me several Chinese temples. Though different in many ways from their Sinhalese counterparts, they exhaled the same atmosphere of peace, for over all brooded the same golden presence with the half-closed eyes and gently smiling lips. He also took me to pay my respects to various prominent Chinese monks. The Venerable Sayak Kyong Hyup, a small figure in black robes, lived alone with his sacred books and images in a quiet street not far from one of the worlds. Whenever he bowed, which was often, one saw on top of his shaven head the scars left by the candles, which, in accordance with Chinese Mahayana tradition, had been burned there at the time of his ordination. These scars signified his readiness to suffer for the sake of all sentient beings. Active, friendly, humble, and courteous, he was indeed a good example of a Bodhisattva monk. Tan Keng Lok told me that a number of Chinese Buddhists came to him for scriptural study. Though he could not speak a word of English, and I knew no Hokkien, we became good friends. I like to think that even in the absence of Tan Keng Lok, who interpreted, we would have understood each other. The Venerable Po Tei, who lived in a small monastery outside the city, might have been the original Laughing Buddha. Unlike the Venerable Siak Kyong Hyup, he wore yellow robes of Sinhalese pattern, which allowed for the exposure of his enormous stomach. His face was the merriest I had ever seen. In illustration of certain abstruse teachings which he was explaining to Tan Keng Lok, he bounced into an inner room. Suddenly a little ticket window in the wall popped open to show his laughing face, which he kept covering with a corner of his robe. Disappearing for a second, he returned to the window with a large black begging bowl. With another burst of laughter, he clicked the window to, and the interview was ended. Tan Keng Lok, who had followed the performance with great interest, afterwards told me that the fat monk was a man of high spiritual attainment and well-versed in meditation. Having made the acquaintance of the Chinese Buddhists, I was eager to get in touch with the other Buddhist communities. From either Buddha Maharaj or Tangkeng Lok, I learned of the existence of a Sinhalese temple on the outskirts of the city. Here, in the tiny reception room, I met the venerable M.M. Mahawira, a placid, somewhat inscrutable person who for a number of years had been the incumbent. Apart from Walpola Rahula, who talked only politics, and a monk in Kandy who wanted to go to America, he was the first Theravadin monk I had met who knew English well enough to discuss simple doctrinal questions. Perhaps because of my Western preconceptions, life at the temple seems not tranquil but merely stagnant. Two or three Sinhalese and one or two Chinese Buddhists were the only visitors. Consequently, I went there much less often than to the ashram. On one of my visits, however, the Venerable Mahawira smilingly told me that three learned Sinhalese monks had arrived and would be staying with him for 2 or 3 weeks. This was an opportunity not to be missed. The monks were the famous trio Soma, Kiminda, and Panasila. They had been invited, it transpired, to work in an institute of Buddhist studies in eastern China, but finding it impossible to cross the communist-held territory which lay between them and their destination, had decided to retrace their steps and were now on their way back to Ceylon. Bhikkhu Soma, who bore the brunt of my questioning, was a frowning, thick-set man of mixed Dutch and Sinhalese descent. Like Kayminda, he was of Christian origin and had worked in the post office before ordination. The expression of his features, which were deeply marked with signs of inner stress and strain, was one of grim determination, as though for him the moral and spiritual battle was still being fought. Though strongly adhering to the fundamentalist Theravada Buddhism of Southeast Asia, he was not indifferent to ecumenical issues. In a reply to a question about the more developed Mahayana Buddhism of China, Japan, and Tibet, he declared it could be accepted only to the extent that it agreed with the original Pali scriptures handed down in Ceylon. For a Theravadin to whom development meant degeneration, and who usually rejected the Mahayana in toto as a complete betrayal of Buddhism, this was quite a generous concession. On the subject of the monastic life, Bhikkhu Soma's views were even less conventional. Discussing an incident that had occurred during the voyage, an attempt, it seemed, had been made to seduce him, he declared that the true monk should rise above temptation rather than run away from it, and that he should, if necessary, be able to look at a naked woman without desire. The subject I was most eager to discuss with him, however, was not the acceptability or unacceptability of the Mahayana, or even the right way for a monk to look at a naked woman, but meditation. Producing a slender booklet on Anapanasati, or mindfulness of the process of respiration, which I had bought in Ceylon, I asked if he could recommend the method it described. Bhikkhu Soma's reply was unhesitating. "It was the best of methods," he said, "the method employed by the Buddha on the eve of his enlightenment." In fact, having himself derived great benefit from it, he had translated the canonical text in which it was expounded into English, together with its commentary. A copy of this work, together with 2 or 3 other books he had published, he presented to me. That night, for the third time since leaving England, I sat beneath my mosquito net, meditating while others slept. The unit had been shifted to a group of houses in another suburb, and there were now 5 or 6 of us to a room. This time success was immediate. My mind became at first buoyant, then filled with peace and purity, and finally penetrated by a quintessential keen ethereal bliss that was so intense I had to break off the practice. Obviously, the conditions under which I was then living were not ideal for meditation. I therefore resolved to continue the practice later, when they had become more favourable. This resolution I kept. Though the Theravada sectarianism of Bhikkhu Soma and the author of the Slender Booklet was the antithesis of my own acceptance of the entire Buddhist tradition in all its ramifications, I remain grateful to them for having introduced me to a practice which was for a long time the sheet anchor of my spiritual life.